Merci pour l'introduction. It reminds me of the old days when I was in the rock and roll band in high school. Well, maybe before we move, just a very short remark, before we move away from Heidegger, well, he's always there. First of all, I would like to really thank to my students from my Heidegger class for coming and also for posing great, very to-the-point questions, really, that makes a teacher proud. One would expect that I would be talking about my thesis, but this won't be the case.
That's what I expect.
Then you will be sorely disappointed. What I will be doing, I will pay a little tribute, in fact, to Christine Howells by giving a little talk on Sartre. Well, I'll be paying tribute to Taylor Kerman, I hope, in restaurant by discussing the Heidegger. This is the best way how to do. Well, I will start by telling you a very short story. It is September 1939. And France has just declared war on Nazi Germany. Jean-Paul is standing on a bridge in Saint-Tré, a small town near the German border, watching a river that flows from the nearby Vosges. I cannot, in fact, pronounce this mountain, so I will skip it. Maybe Ferry won't will be do that for me.
Les Vosges.
Les Vosges. He is 34 years old. It won't be long before his childhood dream comes true. He will become the great writer Jean-Paul Sartre. In 1939, however, he is still only the promising author of the novel Nausea and the short story collection The Wall, and one of the pioneers of phenomenologic philosophy here in France. The plays that will be staged around the world have not yet been written, and phenomenology too is still waiting for its heyday in France. The young Sartre enlists 3 weeks ago and expect to move to the front soon. The thoughts of death that run through his mind are different than ever before. He always imagined he would die an old man years after he had finished his oeuvre. His death will complete his life when he is satisfied with it. This notion now seems naive to him. The day before his expected deployment, he sees clearly that death may come at any moment and put an end to all plans. It never completes one's life, it only ends it. On this late September day, he sees clearly for the first time the absurdity of death. He stands on the bridge and looks at the river flowing below. He thinks of his work, which has been only recently begun to find its resonance. He may never be able to write another book. Perhaps his work, to which he has devoted his entire adult life, will always remain unfinished. He also thinks of his lover, Wanda, whose love he constantly doubts. He may never find peace and happiness with her. Perhaps their relationship will forever remain full of manipulation and jealousy. And finally, he thinks of Castro. She writes to him from Paris to reassure him and herself, no doubt, that he is immortal. But in fact, he doesn't want to be immortal. He wants his life to be fulfilled. The relationship with her is also the only thing that fulfills his life at this moment. In fact, every day he waits for her letter. Every day for a long time now, her view of the world complements and enriches his. Life without her would be a desert. He stares into the water stream and thinks of a world in which he will no longer be alive. It's not too hard. For 3 weeks, he has felt more dead than alive. Will his books attract readers after his death? Will they make an impression on those he will never know and shape a world he himself will never see? Will not those who know him best and shape his world most of all forget him? But what if they lose this war in the end? What will remain of this world at all? What will be left of his readers? What will happen to those he cares about most? He turns his gaze away from the water depths and crosses the bridge to the other side. Perhaps he will write a philosophical article on death. As we know, Sartre never wrote this article. However, he carefully noted down the experience he had in Saint-Tré at the end of September 1939 in his war diary. These notes, along with other reflections he added in the weeks and months that followed, become the basis for the chapter My Death in his major philosophical work, Being and Nothingness, published a few years later. This chapter, less than 20 pages long, now ranks, along with the chapter on Being Towards Death from Heidegger's Being and Time, and several texts of various genres and scopes by Levinas, among the three most well-known contributions of the 20th century philosophy to the question of death. Heidegger argues, as we just heard in detail, that the understanding of our own death is the only possibility of our self-understanding as such. He impressively demonstrates how we nevertheless first and foremost conceal the understanding of our death to ourselves, and how we become ourselves in the proper sense only when we look our own death in the face. He then provides us with an ontological interpretation of such authentic self-understanding and reads from it the original temporality of our existence. Because of its existential urgency and its ontological depth, Heidegger's reflections on death have been read for a nearly century. Levinas argues, on the contrary, that we find death above all inscribed in the face of the other. The mortality of the other, then, according to Levinas, constitutes an unconditional ethical commitment that makes each of us, without exception, responsible for each other. In doing so, he connects the ethical gravity of death to a phenomenological description of the emotional upheaval we suffer from the death of a loved one, which forever transforms our own selves. Due to the impending global ecological crisis and global pandemic, Levinas' reflections on death are more widely read now than when they were first published. Sartre, lastly, argues that death is the limit that, from the outside, demarcates the realm of possibilities of our freedom. Well, maybe I'm too fast. He dramatically depicts how death defies all our expectations and interrupts all our plans. Furthermore, he reflects on how, after our death, the meaning of our lives is dependent on the memory and forgetfulness of others. For a long time, therefore, Sartre's reflection of death have been seen as a modern justification of the ancient dictum that the living ones are not concerned with their own death, and few people bother with them today. However, the Epicurean reading of Sartre's contribution to the discussion of death did not appear until nearly 40 years after the publication of Being and Nothingness. It was proposed by André Béraud, the leading French commentator on Heidegger and longtime director of the Husserl Archives here at the NNS, in the late 70s. Mm-hmm. Yes, César. No, it's fine. I'm just using the moment for. André Béraud gave a lecture on death in Sartre philosophy at one Sartre conference in Brussels and formulated a thesis that would determine how the chapter My Death would be read in the decades to come. And I quote from the lecture, Sartre rephrases the ancient argument, as long as I am there, I am not dead. As soon as death surprises me, I am dead. There is therefore no one who participates in this encounter. Death escapes me, but precisely because it escapes me by its absurdity, its inhumanity, its externality, its contingency, its violence, I can escape it too, he or I. Perfectly cruel, untamed, untamable, cruelty perfectly useless, death is ridiculous. Well, it's apparent that it was written by a French writer.
Excuse me?
It's quite apparent that this was written by a French writer.
French professor,
for sure, from Sorbonne. And director of the archives. In the 90s, this Béraud's interpretation was taken up by another very famous French professor, Françoise Dastir, in her acclaimed book, Death and Essay on Finitude. And the Epicurean reading of Sartre gradually became mainstream. However, already in Sartre's War Diaries, just a few pages after the Saint-Tri entry I used for the introduction of my paper, we can read Epicurus' famous argument, don't be afraid of death. What does it matter if your works remain unfinished, since you will no longer be there to suffer from the fact that they do? The argument which has long satisfied me is worthless. Perhaps the now classic reading of Sartre's reflection on death, in the end, inverts their very own message. Perhaps my death concerns me precisely because it will be experienced by the others I care about, Perhaps it consumes me precisely because of its absurdity, as it interrupts my projects in the world I hold dear. Perhaps it consumes me precisely because of its unexpectedness, since I never know at what point I will have to leave this world and lose the opportunity to shape it any further. I will therefore look a little more closely at Sartre's forgotten critique of Epicurus. Sartre is not, however, the only critique of Epicurus. To take issue with Epicurus' reflections on death and possibly ridicule him a little bit is a favorite activity of authors writing about death in the 20th and 21st centuries. Epicurus' reflections are usually reduced to a single sentence, which is then paraphrased in various ways and with greater or lesser degrees of completeness and accuracy. This sentence, which is also one of the most famous sentences of ancient philosophy, is found in the letter which Epicurus addresses to Meneusius. And I quote from classic, probably classic English translation from the 50s, "Therefore death, the most frightening of evils, is nothing to us, for the excellent reason that why we live, it's not here, and when it is here, we are not living." This sentence is not particularly difficult to interpret. For Epicurus, as for other ancient authors, death is the separation of the soul from the body. For Epicurus then, as for the proponent of atomism, the soul and body are composed of minuscule material particles. The soul, which is composed of finer ones than the body, and which represents the principle of life, permeates the body and gives it the capacity to perceive. The body, which envelops the soul, protects the fragility of the soul and endows it with the organs to use. In another letter addressed to Herodotus, we learn that the moment the body disintegrates, the soul also disintegrates. For without the body, it's neither able to perceive, feel or think, nor hold itself together. This moment is, of course, the moment of death. We cannot experience it because the disintegration of the unity of body and soul puts an end to all perception. We cannot survive it because the soul, the principle of life, dies with the body. Most modern writers who are attracted and repelled by Epicurus' statement at the same time more or less tacitly accept Epicurus' thesis that death is the end of life and that it as such cannot be experienced, for they almost all abandon the hypothesis of an immortal soul. On the other hand, they all loudly protest against the conclusion that Epicurus draws from this thesis, that death does not concern us. This criticism can be summed up in the following two objections. First, it's argued that Epicurus overlooks the relationship we have with our own death while we are still alive. If we and death cannot be here at the same time, and that we can make such statements about death as Epicurus does, then this means that our death is here insofar as we relate to it while we ourselves are still here. This objection is raised primarily from phenomenological position, for the authors whose philosophical program consists of an introspective description and subsequent ontological interpretation of intentionality, the problem of death is precisely the problem of our relationship with death. Scheler calls Epicurus' argument sophistry. Patočka calls directly its author the laziest thinker of the antiquity. The most precise formulation of this objection is probably found in Levinas' Time and the Other. And I quote again, "The ancient adage designed to dissipate the fear of death, if you are, it is not, if it is, you are not, without doubt misunderstands the entire paradox of death, for it effaces our relationship with death, which is a unique relationship with the future." The logic operating behind this objection is rather simple. From the correct premise of why we live, death is not here, and when it's here, we are not living, Epicurus draws the erroneous conclusion that death is nothing to us, and therefore fails to reach the necessary conclusion that the problem of death lies in the relationship we have with it. In fact, Heidegger does the same thing without criticizing Epicurus explicitly, but he starts from the very a priori formulated by Epicurus in section, well, it's 40-46. We will be reading that at the beginning of next semester. But those who raise this objection do not read Epicurus very carefully, for his argument is itself an answer to the problem of the relationship we have with our death. The own purpose of the argument is not to deny this relationship, but to transform it from the fear that death awakens to the indifference, ataraxy, with which we can face it. Our relationship with death is transformed once we realize that death, the most frightening of evils, is in fact no evil at all. The materialist Epicurus defines what is good and what is evil consistently on the basis of sense perception. Good are those things whose sensation give pleasure to our bodies and bring peace to our souls. Bad things are, on the contrary, those whose perceptions cause us pain and whose anticipation awakens fear. Death, however, which puts an end to all our perceptions, is neither good nor evil. It is therefore pointless to fear it, as it is pointless to long for it. She who understands what death is and becomes accustomed to this understanding becomes, Epicurus claims, indifferent to her own death. The second objection, well, it's very scholarly, I see now, which is raised against Epicurus' argument is directed at Epicurus' interpretation of fear of death, which his argument presupposes. We do not fear death because we fear the pain that death will cause us, or that will perhaps follow after death, but because we wish our life and the lives of our loved ones to continue. A recent version of this also very classic objection formulated by Karl Jaspers, Marta Nussbaum, can be found in the book Dying for Time by the Swedish philosopher and friend of Dale Carmen, as far as I know, Martin Hägglund. When Epicurus argues that there is no reason to fear death, and I quote, to fear death because death is nothing to us, it is not something we can experience because our death excludes our existence, he misconstrues what is at stake in the fear of death. To fear death is not to fear the state of being dead, which indeed will be nothing at all to the living being who is afraid of dying, but to fear the loss of what one wants to keep. There is a simple logic behind this objection as well. It is argued that Epicurus fails to see that the fear of death is actually the fear of life that is to be lost. If Epicurus then aims to transform this fear into the indifference towards death, he aims, as a consequence, to achieve indifference towards life. For if we care about our own life as well as about the life of others, we will never completely rid ourselves of the fear of death. Probably we will hear more about it from Fredrik Worms later. But even these critics oversimplify Epicurus. He himself, in fact, distinguishes between various forms that the fear of death can take. He does not address only those who fear the suffering they associate with the coming of death, but also those who fear the necessity of this coming. Or in other words, those who fear the finite time of their lives. That is what would be anxiety in Heidegger. The claim that death is painless, as it represents the end of all perception, is therefore not enough on its own to dispel the fear of death. If the fear of death is to be shown to be groundless, the desire for an infinitely long life must also be shown to be groundless. This desire is dispelled, the Epicureans claim, if we see that an infinite life would be no better and no more desirable than a finite life. This is the purpose served by the argument which we find among the so-called main ideas of the Epicurean doctrine, and according to which an infinite quantity of time adds nothing to the quality of the blessed life. The blessed life is the life which is filled with the pleasure which comes from the satisfaction of the desires of the body and the dissipation of the restlessness of the soul. If such a life could last indefinitely, the pleasure that fills it would be no more intense, no more varied, it would be only indefinitely longer. She who glimpses what the blissful life consists in can therefore, Epicurus argues, be indifferent to the fact that this life too will one day come to an end. Indifference to death then does not lead to indifference to life. Indifference to death, on the contrary, presupposes a concern for the life that matters to us and whose bliss is itself consummated. The Epicureans carry this conclusion to its extreme when they add that he or she who has attained wisdom does not mourn even the death of loved ones, because she rejoices in the time spent together, even though it be a finite time. The Epicurean approach to death is therefore neither a Western variant of the Buddhist one, nor an ancient precursor of Schopenhauer's. A rigorous critique of it must show that even the most blissful and fulfilled life can never be completely indifferent to death as it relates to its very bliss and fulfillment. Such a critique of Epicureanism is formulated by Sartre, who is interpreted by commentators as its contemporary proponent. The objection that Sartre raises against Epicurus is already contained in the way he parodies his statement. I will quote it again. Epicurus' famous argument, "Don't be afraid of death. What does it matter if your works remain unfinished, since you will no longer be there to suffer from the fact that they do? The argument which has long satisfied me is worthless." Sartre does not object to Epicurus like other phenomenologists for overlooking the relationship we have with our death, nor does he object that he mistakes death for the state of being dead. Sartre does not mock Epicurus because Epicurus has overlooked or mistaken something. Sartre is mocking the basic premise of the famous argument, Epicurus's hedonism. The Epicurean doctrine of death is worthless, according to Sartre, because the Epicurean doctrine of life is worthless too. If the Epicureans maintain that the goal of life is the pleasure that comes from a satisfied body, a found peace of soul, then for them the world and the others who inhabit it becomes means which serve exclusively to achieve the pleasurable feeling of life. They therefore withdraw into privacy, into their gardens, and seek out others only to spend a pleasant time with them. Epicurus's famous argument about death does not satisfy Sartre when he thinks about death himself on the front, primarily because he is not satisfied by this doctrine of life. The polemics continue a few lines below as follows. I quote again, "However, when we strive for something, what matters is the success of our efforts in the world and not their success for us. In fact, every enterprise is desirable and undertaken for its own sake against the backdrop of the world." Between these lines, which Sartre addresses to Epicurus in his war diary, lie, in fact, the basis thesis of his existentialism, even in 1939. If I am a self-conscious and, that is, a free being, then this world does not appear to me merely as the sum of the means to satisfy my own desires and to achieve my own pleasure. This world is also, and above all, the place where I project my life upon my possibilities and the place which I, in turn, shape through my life projects. The others, too, whom I inhabit this world are not merely those who accompany me in my seeking of pleasure, but they are also, and above all, those who I'm addressed with my life projects. Sometimes it is those who I'm trying to offer and deliver something, sometimes it is those to whom I'm trying to resist or revolt against them. But it is always those before whose eyes I live my life and therefore, and before whose eyes I am becoming who I am perpetually and forever until I'm dead. Certainly, I can see the goal of my life as the pursuit of pleasure, and I can subordinate all my life projects to that goal. I can withdraw into seclusion, limit my interaction with others to the minimum necessary, and enjoy the pleasant company of a selected few. I can, even at the beginning of the 21st century, become an Epicurean. In fact, if you visit the dating sites here in Paris, many people claim to be Epicureans today to attract potential partners. Yet, by choosing this life project, I will still address others and shape a future guise of this world. For in the way I project my own life, I will, willingly or not, create a norm and a living example of how to live in this world. Probably no one knew this better than Epicurus himself, who, according to Diogenes Laertius, put his philosophy into more than 300 writings. But the attitude of life, this philosophy proclaims, is only one possible way to take hold of one's own life. The pleasure that springs from the satisfaction of bodily desires and dissipation of mental sorrows, or sorrows of the soul, will never alone fulfill human life. For a self-conscious and free being always seeks to make his life meaningful. If this meaning is lost, or when it's absent for a long time, human life becomes unlivable. even if its basic biological needs are perfectly satisfied. A meaningful life can also be painful, and arguably, it is, in a lot of cases. If I strive to make my life meaningful, then it matters to me. I'm successful in carrying out my project, and also that this project finds resonance with the others. I care about the success of my efforts in the world, as Sartre put it. If I fail to realize any of them, or if any of my projects prove futile, I will try to project my life anew. My death, however, will put an end to the realization of all my projects and deprive me of all possibilities. Sartre's polemic with Epicurus thus continues with a simple statement. I quote very short quote. Death is the end of our efforts, of all our efforts. That is to say, my death will put an end to all my projects before I realize them or withdraw from them. In the light of my projects and my efforts, it stands out as pure absurdity. This is the main claim of the chapter of my own death in being a nothingness. Or let's say one of the three main claims. The existentialist answer to Epicurus already offers itself. If I strive by the very nature of my subjectivity to give meaning to my life, how can I be indifferent to an event that deprives my life of that meaning? But this is not the actual point of Sartre's reply to Epicurus. Just before getting to it, it's worth asking the following question. Isn't actually Epicurus' doctrine of death that, in a unique and timeless way, makes it possible to achieve indifference precisely to the absurdity of death? Is not the Epicurean way of life precisely immune to the unexpectedness of death because it derives its meaning from goals that are realizable every day? After all, is it not an Epicurean more sober and stronger in this crucial respect than the one who finds meaning in his life in far-reaching goals who demand much of the world? Sartre argues why this is not the case. And I quote probably for the last time, "We understand our own death against the background of the world. We do not think of it at all as Epicurus would wish, as the annihilation of the world for us, along with our own annihilation, but as our annihilation in the world that continues." To elucidate Sartre's point here, let us remind ourselves that in many languages we say the dead passed away or are gone, as we heard. This phrase is not merely a way of softening a disturbing and often painful effect, nor does it necessarily convey, though it often does, the hope that the dead are passing on to some other world where we may one day meet them again. This phrase says, above all, that the dead leave us alone in this world. They leave us alone with plans and projects that we will never realize together and with expectation that will never be fulfilled in a world full of things that belong to them and the places they inhabited. They leave us alone in the world that keeps reminding us of them. If it's said that the dead are passing away, it's the very essence of death that is being spoken of. It is implied that we die in the world that continues, as Sartre says. If we are aware of our mortality, then this is what we are aware of. Sooner or later, we will have to leave everything we care about in this world behind. All the projects we have not yet completed, along with all the little joys that everyday life brings us, all the things we cherish, all with all the places we hold dear, and of course, all those we love and worry about. We understand also that we will leave all this to others, and that it will be them who will either take up our efforts and concern for their own or not. Can we be aware of this and yet remain indifferent to our death? There are those among us who have achieved the goals they set for themselves in life and live with the feeling that they have fulfilled their lives. Most of them will also be more or less reconciled with their death. But they will also be concerned about how others remember them after their death. Even those who care more about how they live, let's say in the moment, than their legacy, will not be indifferent to their death, They will care about the fate of the person close to them, whom they leave behind in death, and necessarily about the shape of the world they leave behind. For the awareness of our own mortality is the awareness that all that we care about in this world will have to be left behind. This awareness came over Sartre in autumn of 1939, after he had enlisted and the work he cared about was on the brink of destruction. This awareness also led to his break with Epicurus, and it speaks volumes in all the texts he wrote about that thereafter. This can be readily seen in the famous lecture Existentialism is Humanism, which he delivered at a historical moment after the end of the war in the autumn of 1945. This is the last quote, probably, or second to last, in very old English translation, because I haven't found any newer. Tomorrow, after my death, men may choose to impose fascism, while others may be cowardly or distraught enough to let them get away with it. Fascism will then become humanity's truth, and so much the worse for us. Sartre's critique of a pure statement about death reveals the basic premise of this statement, which has remained hidden from other critics. Our death is never only about ourselves, because we always die in the world we inhabit with others. In his war diary, Sartre makes this premise explicit when he says that Epicurus identifies our own nihilation, which is represented by our death, with the nihilation of the world as such. In the chapter My Death, From Being in Nothingness, he says it more directly when he speaks of the error of those who think that my death concerns only myself. We are not surprised, then, when Sartre writes in a brief passage in the Notebooks for an Ethics that the acceptance of death represents the highest generosity of which human beings are capable of. If we accept our death, then we accept that everything we hold dear in this world will sooner or later have to be left behind and left to others. The acceptance of this fact, which Sartre evokes, stands in sharp contrast to the indifference towards death that does not concern us, which Epicurus calls for. The acceptance of this fact is captured by the words of the painter Edvard Munch, who is on display now in Paris, and you can read, in fact, these very words on the wall of the exhibition. This is also for our guests probably invitation to visit before they leave. And these are the words: we do not die, the world dies from us. Thank you.
That's from Munch.
Yeah, that's Munch.